This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Black political prisoner Reverend Edward Pinckney speaks from the dungeons of the Michigan prison system. Dr. Gerald Horn examines Washington's plans for regime change in Venezuela. And why is it that Black girls are 6 times as likely to be kicked out of school as white girls?
But first, former Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney says Black people have no stake in the Republican or Democratic parties. McKinney was the Green Party's presidential candidate in 2008. She has since earned her PhD in leadership and change. We asked McKinney if she had ever seen anything like the current disarray in both major parties in this election season.
Of course, you already know the answer to that, and that is no. And this is a situation I believe that political scientists are going to be writing about and studying about for a very long time. And of this very important political moment, basically the idea that I have is that Black voters, I don't know a nice way to say that honestly, we don't have any stake at all in the continuation of either the Democrat or Republican parties as they are currently constituted. And so the implosion of the duopoly, as you put it, is something that I believe is of great political import to the Black community. The problem is, however, that we have got to be organized in order to have an imprint on what is produced in the outcome, how those ashes, as they might be, get reconstituted into a political system that is befitting of our community and all of the communities within the United States of America. The United States itself is on a huge path of change, and it could go way or the other. And we have seen the dissolution of the Bill of Rights, such as it was for Blacks in the United States. And even that has been ripped to shreds. And we've got a surveillance state that puts COINTELPRO to shame. Now all communities are being subjected to the likes of a COINTELPRO, a counterintelligence program. And so, therefore, the United States is substantively changing. How we can impede the negatives of that change and propel the positives of that change are what are consuming my thoughts at the moment.
Paul Street says Democrats under Clinton are well underway to becoming the most pure expression of the ruling class in the United States.
And that is why many Republican establishment figures are fleeing to Hillary Clinton, which tells us about the state of the Democratic Party as an alternative. It never really was an alternative. It was an alternative only in the minds of the voters who were tricked and fooled and bamboozled into thinking that if they cast a vote for a candidate that had a D behind their name, that they were actually voting for a different policy. And so whether it was war policy, Wall Street policy, or domestic policy for that matter, treatment of African-American community, there was huge consensus within the two, that duopoly, on how we were to be treated. And now, of course, that consensus has spread throughout both political parties such that Democrats were aware of the surveillance state that the United States had become, but they didn't fight against it either. And instead, out of the mouth of a Donald Trump, you get the Europeans need to pay for NATO. Look right now at the saber rattling that the U.S. political elite are doing against Russia and China. Instead of reaching out to Russia and China, the United States is using our tax dollars to threaten China in the South China Sea and at the front door threshold of Russia in Ukraine. So the duopoly elite have, I believe, reneged on their, maybe they're just demonstrating that they never really had a commitment to protecting the people of the United States. And so now I believe that the fractures inside the Republican Party, as well as the fractures inside the Democratic Party, have come to the forefront. And the things that I have spoken about, campaigned against, criticized, introduced legislation to change, now everybody sees, for example, how the pernicious effect of these superdelegates and how the will of the people can be stolen in the so-called democracy, and the will of the people no longer be reflected inside the democratic process. It has made the state of democracy in the United States a farce, and it's a farce that the rest of the world is looking at. But I hope it's a farce that, most importantly, the people inside the United States are learning that their system never really intended to represent them anyway.
Could we see the two-party duopoly system being replaced by maybe a multi-party system, three or four major parties vying for voters in this country?
There are many different theories about what could come next or what should come next. And we have seen that when we have this representative form of government, I don't want to get too theoretical here, but the representative form of government, basically, we, the people who have the power in a democracy, give our power over to people, and then we go to those very same people that we have given our power to, and we beg them to enact policy that makes sense to us. Well, that system doesn't make sense in the first place. That is indirect democracy. And so what the Jamahiriya in Libya was experimenting with was the same kind of democracy that exists in Switzerland, and that's direct democracy, where the people themselves make the policy and the people themselves decide what is best for them without handing over their policy-making power to a set of people who become distanced from them. So there's the abandonment of the current kind of democracy that we have. There are tweaks that we can make inside the system that we have now. For example, I introduced a long time ago, when I was in the Congress, I introduced the Voters' Choice Act, which would have repealed the single member district and allowed for proportional representation. And what that means is that there would not be a winner-take-all system. We would have more of a system of power sharing that also allowed for the existence of more political parties, as you initially stated. So a combination of a change in the system of our voting and the winner-take-all character of it that we have in the U.S., along with a proliferation of parties, would allow us to have more representation. Because ultimately, what we are doing now is we're going through the motions of electing a representative. As I have said too many times, it makes me sick to say it again, but we have a representative and we have no representation. The whole point of an indirect democratic system is that the people supposedly have representation and that their ideas and their values have representation. That is something that because of the pernicious effects of money. That's another tweak to the system that needs to be changed, is that we need to have public financing of elections. There needs to be giving the airwaves during political campaigns back to the people. This is another point that Trump brought out. There's a tremendous amount of money that these broadcasters are making on the citizens' right to know for whom they are going to cast their vote. And that makes no sense at all, because the system has become basically a closed loop, where in order to enter, it takes a lot of money. In order to stay, it takes even more money. And much of that money is spent on the media buying ads 30 seconds at a time, when the most effective way — why should CNN and Fox and all of the rest of them make money? Because they are airing debates that every candidate should be involved in anyway. So we can tweak the system with the removing the impact of the private money, freeing our airwaves to candidates. There used to be the equal time requirement. That's gone by the wayside. So we could even go back to some of the things that we had before. Then, of course, these voting tweaks, so that we remove the winner-take-all system that we have now and allow for the creation of more political parties and their expression inside the political process of actually being able to get their candidates elected. Those are just a few of the tweaks that we could do relatively easily. Oh, and I haven't even gone to the Electoral College. So those are just a few of the tweaks that we could do that don't entail wholesale radical dissolution of the system that we currently have, but that would make the system a lot more fair for everyone involved, particularly the voters who deserve to have choice in terms of for whom they vote and who ultimately gets elected.
You, of course, ran for president under the Green Party banner in 2008. What role do you think the Greens will play in 2016?
Well, of course, I would hope that the Green Party would become one of the institutionalized parties. But, you know, every party has to have internal democracy as well. And so what I would hope is that the Green Party would be available on more ballots. We just had a significant victory, although the state of Georgia is still fighting that victory. But ultimately, people in the state of Georgia might soon be able to cast a vote for a Green Party labeled candidate. And that's a shame that it has taken so long, so much effort, in order to just get our candidates fielded on the ballot as Green Party candidates, or for that matter, as any other political party than the Democrats and the Republicans. The Libertarians were grandfathered in legislation, but other political parties face a very, very difficult time getting their candidates on the ballot. And then you've got 50 different laws, because the balloting procedures vary from state to state. So the Green Party, and even people with no party, just independents, should be able to participate fully in the political system, which is not the case today.
With all this discussion about party realignments and the potential for new parties, there's still no Black national political party.
No, there's no alternative Black party. And 1972 was the Gary, Indiana conference. And this idea has been bandied about for a while, and we still don't have it. And that is because the people who are able to finance their ideas or get their ideas financed are the ones that are basically status quo people. And the status quo leaders do perfectly well having the bulk of the Black community on the Democratic Party plantation. nothing changes for Black people, but everything changes for those particular individuals.
That was former Congresswoman from Georgia, Cynthia McKinney.
Political activists from around the nation are planning to be in Philadelphia in late July for the Democratic National Convention. Dr. Anthony Montero is a native Philadelphian, a member of the Black Radical Organizing Committee, and one of the organizers of last January's National Conference on the Black Radical Tradition. Dr. Montero says this is the most consequential election season in perhaps a century.
Certainly it's exciting from a standpoint of those of us who have studied and practiced the science and arts of social transformation, but it's, I think, the most consequential election, certainly in the last, let us say, 100 years, and maybe ever. The fate not only of the nation is being decided and will be decided over the course of what comes out of all of this, you know, and saying the years ahead, the months ahead. We are at a turning point. The country is being transformed, and no one can predict success and what success will ultimately look like. So, yeah, I suspect that upwards of several hundred thousand, maybe more, some are saying as many as a million protesters could descend on the city of Philadelphia. They're coming by any means they can use to get here, including a contingent of people are walking from Washington, D.C. I suspect they are the Democracy Spring people. There are people coming from every part of the country and from around the world. I understand that the Haitians are organizing busloads to come here to protest. So the very weight of the perhaps hundreds of thousands of protesters will be felt, and their weight will be thick in the air, both inside the convention and in the city. And that weight of people's power will resonate throughout the nation. We're at a different stage of history. The people are in the streets, and they're not going home anytime soon.
Certainly the fate of the two duopoly parties is at stake. The Democrats in Philadelphia, the Republicans in Cleveland. Could we emerge from this drama at some point with more than two parties in the United States?
I think if there is anything that is certain in this whole situation, it is that the two-party duopoly has reached what is, in fact, its end. Leading Republican intellectuals like Andrew Sullivan have said that the Republican Party faces an existential crisis, which is another way of saying it faces a life and death crisis with Trump. Trump, as you know, about a week ago, when interviewed by Bloomberg News, said that if he becomes president in 5 to 10 years, he would transform the Republican Party into a workers' party, and those are his words, a party of the people, as he put it, who hadn't gotten a wage increase for over 18 years. This is huge. Donald Trump, on the one side, has broken with every Republican orthodoxy, from the position on war and containment of Russia and the military containment of North Korea and the military occupation of the Korean Peninsula and Japan, to the whole question of cutting Social Security. He has said he wouldn't cut it. So once you undermine the ideological and policy foundations of a party and win that party's nomination, we are looking at, in effect, the end of that party and the conditions for the emergence of something new. On the Democratic side, it's not as dramatic, although it is as important, but not as dramatic. Bernie Sanders' movement is a movement that is challenging the elite and the power brokers and the money bags within the Democratic Party but he has not gone as far as Trump and his movement have gone to challenge American hegemony and American empire. But nonetheless, I'm convinced that each of these movements see themselves in the other, that these are two movements that will inevitably join forces in a common front against austerity and war. So things look good in the short run and medium and long term as far as I can see.
Hillary Clinton seems intent on creating her own kind of common front, a common front of everybody against Donald Trump, a big tent kind of party that would also encompass lots of Republicans. Do you think she'll pull this off?
No. I think the elites are uniting against Trump and against Sanders. In fact, Thomas Friedman, a regular columnist in the New York Times, said the other day that Trump and Sanders were liars, and Hillary only told small ones and really was only guilty of lapses in judgment. But Trump and Sanders are liars. So from the standpoint of the elite, they see what Trump and Sanders represent as a single threat, and a threat coming from the working people and the poor and the lower middle classes. We have never seen anything like this. I would suggest that we see in this election period the politicization of the working people and the poor, by which I mean that working people and poor people are entering this election cycle on political terms that they more or less define. And I contextualize these class politics in this moment as anti-war, anti-austerity, anti these neoliberal trade and globalization policies. This is huge.
Based on voting behavior and on polls, black folks appear to be the most loyal to the right-wing Democrats under Hillary Clinton of any other group.
And I would emphasize in your statement the word appeared. The situation is very fluid. In the South, at the beginning of the primary season, Hillary Clinton was getting upwards of 95% of the black vote, of course, in a very, very low turnout, and in a part of the country where politics are kind of neo-Jim Crow politics going back to the defeat of Reconstruction in the 1870s. The South has not yet recovered from that. But as primary season moved north into states like Michigan, Missouri, Illinois, the black vote began to show itself in a different way. And rather than this 90-some percent of the black vote, Hillary was getting 70 and into the 60%. Now, this is very important given that the Clinton machine kind of owns most of black politics. But I think going forward, the black millennials will join their generational cohort on the other side of the color line and be a driving force against the Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton machine and the black sellout class. I think this is going to be a historic turn. What appears now, I don't think is completely accurate, as it was not accurate in Indiana, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, in Missouri, and in other states.
Could this new force emerge as a force outside of the Democratic Party?
Well, I think definitely. That's the whole point of the closed and open primaries. It is when you have an open primary, all of those people, especially young people, who consider themselves socialists, could not bring themselves to register in either the Democrat or Republican parties, which they view rightly as capitalist parties. And if they're socialists, their ideological and moral position would not allow them to be identified with either of those parties. Nonetheless, an insurgent movement attracts them to the Democratic Party as part of a overall insurgency against the ruling elite of the nation. So a lot of these black young people, many of whom never registered because they don't believe in American bourgeois politics, will join this movement because it is a movement more than just an election. So that's what I'm looking at. And you'll see it here in Philadelphia in July. You're going to see a lot of young black people, and a lot of them are going to come from the ghettos and barrios of Philadelphia.
Hillary Clinton has already started her national campaign, and she's wooing lots of Republicans who, for some reason or other, cannot stomach Trump. She's talking about she herself being the person that can go toe-to-toe with Beijing. She charges that Trump won't honor the U.S. commitments to NATO and such. Do you think that this will resonate among the lefter elements of the Democratic Party?
Well, first of all, Clinton is delusional on a lot of levels. She hasn't won the nomination yet. I think we're going to have a contested convention here in Philadelphia. And again, the weight of hundreds of thousands of protesters will be felt in the convention itself. However, she is stating her positions on foreign policy, which are those of the Wall Street and military people. It is a policy of hegemony, of empire, of war, of regime change and nation building and assassinations and sanctions and economic attacks upon sovereign nations and on and on and on. So she stated that. But those are positions she and the neocon and neoliberal elites have held for at least 25 years. But she is railing against Trump, and in so doing, she is giving an opening for a peace sentiment which is widespread and merges with an anti-austerity sentiment. She gives an opportunity by speaking the way she does for this sentiment to galvanize into a conscious anti-war, anti-militarist, anti-empire, anti-austerity movement. You can call that a movement to rebuild America, a movement to end poverty, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the positive side to go along with the anti part of the whole thing. But I think Hillary only makes herself a more inviting target as she more clearly identifies with the most right-wing and militarist and war forces within the country, especially on questions of NATO and the extension of NATO to the borders of Russia, as this applies to provocations and brinkmanship in the South China Sea against China, and the same types of brinkmanship against the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Trump is taking the opposite position. I would only hope that Bernie would get up to speed as in his campaign rhetoric and speeches. Certainly, his movement is where Trump is on these foreign policy questions.
Paul Street has said that with Donald Trump rejecting some of the orthodoxies of the Republican Party, that the Democrats are now emerging as the purest expression and representative of the ruling class in the United States.
Yeah, and that's all good because it validates and confirms what we've been saying all the time, that the two-party system is really a one-party state with two wings. And now it's clear, as the Koch brothers and as the Republican money bags and Republican Party intellectuals like those in the Cato Institute and in the Heritage Foundation and others begin to move towards the so-called Democratic Party or the so-called presumptive Democratic nominee. Now, the problem that they face, as in previous Stop Trump movements, is that Trump is a very difficult force to stop. And I think that is because of the depth and passion of those who are behind him, who have nothing to lose, in fact, who have lost or are losing it all. And we're talking about working people. So I think we're going to have a contested convention. If Bernie wins California, we're looking at a whole new ball game. But nonetheless, what we are seeing is the rise of class politics in the broadest sense of that term, in ways that we have never seen them, and probably in ways that the country has never seen. We have to understand that, and we have to make tactical, strategic, and political decisions based upon an objective and scientific understanding of this new moment in American history.
Of course, Hillary Clinton still has the email scandal hanging over her, a scandal that could make her candidacy unviable.
That's right. And the email scandal is now morphing into more than an email scandal. It is a scandal that is engulfing the Clinton Foundation, the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, which more and more is being looked upon as a criminal enterprise. And what leads me to that conclusion, how the investigation, the FBI investigation is proceeding, is that two things. First of all, if there's evidence for prosecuting Hillary Clinton, it would be under the RICO statutes. And these are laws that you use generally to prosecute criminal types, mafiosi, and people involved in larceny and other things like that. So it's a broad statute. And they're looking at the email thing within the framework of the Clinton Foundation, the solicitation of funds, a foundation which has never faced a very serious auditing, and so on and so forth. The other thing, and this is why I think Hillary is delusional with this idea that she's the presumptive nominee, is that the FBI only a couple of weeks ago began deposing and investigating as a part of the email thing, Terry McAuliffe, the current governor of the state of Virginia, and probably the closest person to the Clintons and the most important person probably in the development of the Clinton Foundation. So this is huge. She might not make it to the nomination. And then if she makes it to the nomination, we're looking at something like a Watergate scandal, but this time on steroids.
Folks are speculating that if somehow the Clinton candidacy becomes hopelessly crippled, that the right-wing forces in the Democratic Party would try to substitute Vice President Biden. But what kind of effect would that have on Bernie and his supporters?
Well, on Bernie and his supporters and on the nation as a whole, what it would validate is what Donald Trump said. The process is rigged, which is another way of saying it is not democratic. It is a machine-controlled process which gives the appearance or creates a fig leaf of people's decision-making and involvement, but in fact it is a manipulated and controlled process for the most part. Now, that having been said, a Biden or Biden-Warren or Kerry or Kerry-Warren kind of ticket, or a Warren substitute, and I think she might have a little bit better sense than to get involved in this, would only deepen the crisis. Because again, you are going to have literally hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Philadelphia. If they do that, you might have a situation of civil unrest and civil uprising.
How would the demise of the duopoly, the supremacy of Tweedledum and Tweedledee, Republicans and Democrats, how would the cracking of that system affect politics in the broad sense in the United States? If we had, say, three major political parties, the Trump Party with lots of racist-inclined white people,
right,
a Democratic Party under the right wing, Hillary types, with support, of course, from the corporate elite, and a left wing social democratic kind of party. What would that do with the political scene as we now see it?
Well, first of all, we're talking about the potentiality and the real potential for a new form of politics. And I would suggest that the precondition for a serious third party is a third people's movement, an independent movement. A lot of people think of, well, we can call a convention and form a third party. Well, that's a forming of a party from above. That's a bureaucratic move. But if we're talking about a new politics, it has to come out of a movement, and a movement that is political in the sense that it is driven by great ideas and a great imagination of an alternative future to that of neoliberal capitalism. Because we're not just talking about third or fourth parties. We're now talking about insurgency parties, parties that are anti-war, anti-empire, anti-American hegemony, anti-austerity, pro-people, pro-rebuilding of the infrastructure, pro-industrial policy that puts people back to work. So that has to come out of a movement where ideas have been discussed, where ideology is the center of politics, not personalities and symbols and rhetoric. So the party question is further down the line. The movement issue is primary. Now, a movement at local levels can produce candidates for mayor, for city council, for Congress, for other positions. But this idea of a single national party is something that can only be successfully put forward, I would think, if the movement reaches a certain level of unity and ideological clarity. So we're in a pre-party movement building stage of this whole process.
And we'll see manifestations of that movement not too far in the future in Philadelphia at and around the convention.
That's right. And the other thing, Glenn, you know, a lot of people in talking about this moment, this period, talk about it without using, I think, what is the critical concept, crisis. And as some in the elite have put it, which I agree with, existential crisis, the breakdown and delegitimation of the two-party system and their elites creates a legitimation crisis where the people no longer see the elites as legitimate to govern, to rule. We therefore are in a crisis of what we could call bourgeois rule and management of the people. And this filters all the way down to the black misleadership class. If Hillary Clinton is weakened, they're weakened. If her legitimacy is questioned, their legitimacy is questioned because they're linked at the hip to her and to her Wall Street and military backers.
So the black misleadership class clings for dear life to the Hillary campaign.
Absolutely. And a crisis of legitimacy makes the nation, in effect, very difficult to govern, if not ungovernable on the terms that it has been governed for a century. We are looking at something that few of us, none of us in fact, have ever experienced, but which many of us have talked about in the abstract. And now the idea of a post-capitalist future is becoming a concrete reality. And it is ordinary people that are heralding this new moment in our history. And we on the left have to get on board. We're behind the curve right now. We don't ideologically or politically understand this moment, sadly.
So this crack in the duopoly, the delegitimization of rule by the elite, sets loose these forces from below.
Absolutely. That is it. Take the black community. When we talk about the role of the black misleadership class, it is a form of neo-Jim Crow, neo-colonial management of the black masses. It is done through symbolism. It is done through the control and takeover of institutions that are organic to the black community. It is the creating of distractions and so-called pop culture and entertainment. It is the rise of identity politics and Afrocentrism and Afro-nihilism and all of this, which is a modality and form of the rule of the most important and strategic population in the nation, and that is the African-American people. And to add to the, quote, normal methods of rule and management of this black colony, you have also the structures of terror and structural violence that black people, especially the poor, live on a daily basis. So if that is weakened, you free black people from it, and thus the possibility of us re-entering history on the levels that we were accustomed to in the 60s and 70s and 80s and in previous periods in American history.
And of course, for the last 3 years or so, the legitimacy of the mass black incarceration regime has been under steady pressure and question and assault.
That's right. There's no question about it. And, you know, one of the very fascinating things, and I know, you know, you are always following these very important polls of what black people are thinking. But, you know, here you get a situation where the two most well-known African-American political figures are Barack Obama and Cornel West. And in many ways, I would say that Cornel West goes beyond in terms of popular respect for him, goes beyond Barack Obama. He's bigger than Barack Obama, especially when you get to the millennial generation. The significance of that symbology is that the masses of black people are looking for new forms of leadership, that Cornel West represents for tens of millions of people in this country, especially for millions of black people, that alternative to this old, tired, scripted, bootlicking black misleadership class. I think this is very, very important. And frankly, as the generational shift in leadership and in spokespersonship begins to change in the community, as these young people find their way, we are going to see a change in the class configuration of power and authority and leadership in the African-American community. And that's what the anti-police state Black Lives Matter thing was all about and continues to be about. And that's very positive.
Sounds like you're saying black left rising, brother.
Well, it's like I'm saying black left rising, a new kind of black left, a black left which is not weighted down by its old sectarianism, by its formulaic notions about what constitutes change and the ways that change will come about, a left which is more intellectually and ideologically developed. That's what I'm looking at. It is a future left rather than a present left. And of course, all that we have learned in the past is that upon which we stand, but the past is the past. Tomorrow is what is important, the future, and there is a future for the left in a new form, just as we're looking at politics of a new form in this country. The masses have called for it, and the masses will achieve it. The left, as we know it, will have to decide how it comes down on these matters.
Dr. Anthony Montero, speaking from Philadelphia.
Reverend Edward Pinckney is serving a sentence of 30 months to 10 years in prison for allegedly tampering with a voter's petition in his hometown of Benton Harbor, Michigan. The mostly black city has long been under the influence of the Whirlpool Corporation. Reverend Pinckney spoke to Prison Radio on how he became a political prisoner.
You would never, ever see me palling around with Michael Jordan or LeBron James. They believe in the system, the establishment. But Michael Jordan, LeBron James, I, Reverend Edward Pinckney, is here to tell you the system is rigged and corrupt. Anytime an economic system does not feed, clothe, and house its people, it must be and will be overturned and replaced with a system that meets the needs of the people. We must stand up and demand the government serve the people's interests and not those of the corporations. The latest saga in the ruthless pursuit of the corporation rule that is gripping the country is the criminal justice system. I was charged with 5 counts of forgery on a recall petition, which it was no such charge, and then convicted by an all-white jury that was motivated by something other than the truth. The problem here is bigger than the all-white jury that convicted me with no evidence, no eyewitness, no confession, no evidence. The only thing this jury had was the rigged system, the government, and the corporation. The attack on democracy in Benton Harbor and around the country showed that the corporate power structure is determined. They are determined to crush anyone who stands in its way. It is rigged. It is rigged, and the people who buy into it. I was convicted by a corrupt government and the rigged system who fed their listeners the stale bread of hatred to keep everybody divided, and to spoil me to racism by a government that wouldn't protect the lives of its own citizens. Black, poor whites, brown, red, yellow, seeking justice inside the system. Any person, black, white, brown, red, or yellow, who passively accepts the evil of this rigged system and stands on the sideline in this struggle for justice against the corporation is guilty of this corrupt system also. It is me today and you tomorrow. It is not one thing, it's everything about this rigged system. I was one of the first to speak out about the emergency manager law, which allows a non-elected person to take over cities and school districts, replace local officials, sell public assets, privatize public service, dismantle collective bargaining agreements, and more. There are none but dictators in the service of the corporation. Between 2010 and 2014, early 2014, Benton Harbor had 2 different emergency managers, and they stripped the elected city officials of their power and locked them out of their office. The emergency manager went from city to city, taking control, which included Flint, Michigan. The residents accused Governor Snyder, the emergency manager, and other state officials of poisoning more than 100,000 Flint, Michigan residents with contaminated water and requiring payment. The city under a state-appointed manager switched from using Detroit water sources to the Flint River, but did not add corrosion control, causing lead to leak from old plumbing. It is imperative that the atrocity unfolding in Flint sharpen the true nature of this country. It tells you all about this country. The system is rigged. The establishment is corrupt. And the whole damn criminal justice system is corrupt from the top to the bottom, which is designed to destroy the poor, blacks, poor whites, brown, red, yellow, and all other. We must confront the rigged system and expose them for who they are. Let's confront them right now. We need to come together, fight together, stand together, and do what needs to be done.
That was Reverend Edward Pinckney speaking from the Marquette Branch Prison in Michigan.
Studies show that black girls are suspended or expelled from school at 6 times the rate of white girls. Education Week magazine spoke with researchers on the causes of these wildly disproportionate punishments. Adrienne Dixon, a professor of critical race theory at the University of Illinois, had this to say.
Historically, schools have not been places that welcome student agency. There are some of those spaces. They don't typically tend to be in low-income communities of color. I think when kids feel oppressed or repressed, that they respond in the language that they know. And sometimes that's talking back. Sometimes it's not being compliant. And it's misguided interpretations of what it means to teach kids of color and low-income kids of color that they need to be heavily disciplined and heavily surveilled. But I think they're exercising their agency in that way. And that so the schools could recognize these behaviors aren't just because kids just want to be bad, that they're responding to an environment that doesn't help them feel free.
Professor Adrienne Dixon of the University of Illinois.
The United States seems to be closer to its long-time goal of overthrowing the left-wing government of Venezuela. The Venezuelans say Washington is gearing up for a military intervention. Eutrice Lead, host of Lead Stories on the Progressive Radio Network, recently interviewed Dr. Gerald Horn, a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston.
With regard to these manifest problems in Venezuela, that is to say, with government offices being shut down 3 days out of a 5-day work week, with blackouts in terms of electricity, with shortages of consumer goods, including toilet paper, this is obviously a reflection of the fact that, number one, the elites of Venezuela have turned against the Maduro regime, and secondly, they're receiving a certain kind of backing from the North Atlantic community. Not just in the United States, keep in mind that Lufthansa, the German airline, just suspended flying into Caracas, as well as a number of other leading airlines of the North Atlantic nations. And this is increasing the isolation of Venezuela. It's really turning the screws on the Maduro regime. What's even more striking are these rather blatant calls from the Venezuelan elite, oftentimes echoed in Washington, for the military to intervene and overthrow this government, which I thought would be perceived as anti-democratic. And I thought that these folks were in favor of democracy. Silly me. But in any case, frying the ointment there is that recall that during the early days of the first Hugo Chavez regime, that there had been an attempt by the military to overthrow Hugo Chavez. In fact, you might have seen the documentary film about that. And what happened after that abortive coup d'etat, which, by the way, was not only backed in Washington, but there was an editorial in the New York Times, if you go back and check the record, saluting the coup, and they thought it was going to succeed. But after the coup collapsed, what happened is that part of Cuba's assistance, a multifaceted assistance of Venezuela, was bringing in Cuban military to help to train, if you like, or what the opponents would call indoctrinate the Venezuelan military in a more patriotic fashion. And thus far, it does not appear as if the military will be turning against the Maduro regime. But things are so desperate in Caracas right now, I don't think we can rule anything out. At the same time, there are ripples emanating from Venezuela throughout the Caribbean, not only in Trinidad and Tobago, but keep in mind that part of the Chavez policy towards Caribbean nations with the so-called Petro-Caribe policy, the subsidized oil to places like Jamaica and Haiti, et cetera. Well, it's very difficult for Venezuela to keep up its end of the bargain with regard to providing subsidies to Jamaica, Haiti, et cetera. And to the extent that those subsidies are reduced or removed, that's obviously going to have a negative fallout in the Caribbean. Now, the OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Nations, are meeting as we speak in Vienna. And as you know, Venezuela is part of OPEC. The problem with Venezuela is that the price of a barrel of oil was about $110 about a year ago. A few weeks ago, it was about 30 or 35. Now it's up to 50. But that's still not bringing not only the economy of Venezuela out of doldrums, but the economy of Angola and Nigeria and other oil-producing nations. I should also say Russia. At the same time, the Saudis hold the cards there, and they're determined to pursue this policy of keeping oil prices at a certain level. We had thought that it was part of a U.S.-Saudi strategy to put the squeeze on Russia and Venezuela. Then it seemed as if it was part of a Saudi strategy to put the squeeze on U.S. oil producers because the Saudis were concerned about the growth in U.S. domestic oil production. But in any case, $50 a barrel for oil is not enough to help to drag the Venezuela economy out of its present crisis. And so we can expect to see long lines, angry demonstrators, etc.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.